ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. It's Monday, the 13th of April. I'm Melissa Clark in Canberra, coming to you from Ngunnawal country and acknowledging other custodians. United States President Donald Trump says the US Navy will begin a blockade of the Strait of Hormuz after negotiations between the US and Iran failed to land an agreement to end hostilities. It comes as the fragile two-week ceasefire holds for now, with other leaders in the region urging both parties to continue talking. Correspondent Tim Swanston filed this report.
Boarding Air Force Two with a wave to Pakistani mediators. US Vice President J.D. Vance left Islamabad empty-handed. Earlier, in a short press conference, after what he said were 21 hours of negotiations, the Vice President said a deal to end the war hadn't been reached.
We've had a number of substantive discussions with the Iranians. That's the good news. The bad news is that we have not reached an agreement. And I think that's bad news for Iran much more than it's bad news for the United States of America.
In the wash-up of the meeting, both sides were blaming one another for not reaching an agreement. Vice President Vance said Iran had chosen not to accept US terms, saying the US needed a commitment that Iran would not seek a nuclear weapon. For Iran's part, an Iranian semi-official news outlet said the demands were excessive, and Parliamentary Speaker Mohammad Bakir Ghalibaf, who led the Iranian delegation, said the US had not won his team's trust. Iran's foreign ministry spokesperson, Esmail Baghaei, said it shouldn't have been expected that a result would be achieved from one day of talks.
We reached understandings on a number of issues. That's the reality. However, regarding two or three important issues, the views were distant and ultimately did not lead to an agreement.
But if the ceasefire was already looking perilous leading into talks, it became even more fragile hours after.
Joining me now live on the telephone with the very latest is the nation's 45th and 47th President of the United States, President Donald J. Trump.
Phoning in to Fox News, US President Donald Trump elaborated on a social media post he'd just made, saying he'd directed the US Navy to blockade the Strait of Hormuz.
We got a lot of ships, so we're bringing them up. We think that numerous countries are going to be helping us with this also, but we're putting on a complete blockade.
Iran has maintained a stranglehold over the Strait of Hormuz since the beginning of the war, threatening and attacking commercial ships and causing chaos in global energy markets. President Trump said Iran promised to reopen the strait with the ceasefire and knowingly failed. Taking aim at reports Iran was charging a toll for ships to pass through the strait and that sea mines had been placed by Iran, Mr. Trump described Iran's actions as world extortion and a US blockade of the strait would begin shortly. Speaking to Fox News, he also said work would begin on destroying sea mines.
So we have minesweepers there now. We have highly sophisticated underwater minesweepers, which are the latest and the greatest, but we're also bringing in more traditional minesweepers. And so I understand is the UK and a couple of other countries are sending minesweepers. A lot of countries don't have minesweepers.
The US president weighed in on negotiations and said while points that were agreed to were better than continuing military operations, those points didn't matter compared to the single most important issue of Iranian nuclear ambitions. The other issue complicating the ceasefire is Israel's continuing assault on Lebanon and the Iranian-backed militant group Hezbollah. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu crossed into southern Lebanon on Sunday, visiting Israeli soldiers and saying there is more to do. Talks are scheduled between Israeli and Lebanese officials on Tuesday, although crucially, those aren't talks between Israel and Hezbollah. This is Tim Swanston in Dubai reporting for AM.
Professor Usha Haley is an international business expert from Wichita State University in the United States. Professor Haley, what's the most likely short-term impact on oil prices if the US Navy continues to blockade the Strait of Hormuz?
Well, oil prices are expected to rise when they open on Monday. And so that's what's going to happen right away because there's going to be reduced supply. They're already talking about, I think, maybe a 1.5 to 2. They've already gotten about 10 billion barrels a day stopped, and this is going to be another 1.5 billion or so more.
And what happens in the longer term if the straits aren't reopened?
The International Monetary Fund is expected to meet this coming week, and the prognostication is reduced global growth. The global growth projections have varied from 0.5% to 1% down. And so that's what we're expecting. It really depends on how long this conflict goes on, how long the blockade of the strait goes on, and whether critical infrastructure is damaged.
And what's this doing to certainty and the planning prospects for businesses worldwide at the moment as they try and figure out what's happening and how long it might last?
Oh, it's just heightened economic uncertainty all around. Can't make projections. People are expecting prices to rise. It's not just oil, but also everything associated with oil. Certain plastics, certain pharmaceuticals, and of course, fertilizer. It's going to hit farmers really hard.
And how does this current crisis differ from some of the past oil shocks, particularly in terms of that long-term impact?
Well, there's a lot of uncertainty, and then one keeps wondering what we're doing in the Strait of Hormuz. This is not unexpected. It's the only card that Iran has, the Strait of Hormuz. And it's always been factored into any response that Iran would take to aggressive action. So this shouldn't have come as a surprise. The long-term effects really depend on how long this war continues. In my opinion, it's something that could have been avoided, self-inflicted, and it's creating a lot of consternation around the world.
Do you think it will have a broader impact in terms of prompting many governments to consider more sovereign capability? Or is this something that doesn't necessarily disrupt the globalized economic supply chains that have been developed over the last few decades? Is it more of a bump that needs to be negotiated?
No, I mean, it has already affected the global supply of oil. But it's not just that. It's affected fertilizer. It's affected certain other chemicals that flow through. And there is a lot of uncertainty. It has affected the supply chain. It just depends on how long. If it keeps prolonging, it's going to lead to stagflation. I think that's what the IMF is going to come out with in about a week or so. It's a crucial point. I mean, you can't really turn the Strait of Hormuz into a toll booth. And that is what President Trump seems to be wanting to do. It should be a free pathway for ships to go in and out. But I do think, perhaps, although he hasn't really elaborated on it, that this is a hit at China, because Chinese ships were allowed to go through. No one else, really, and mostly Chinese ships. And it will affect China, but minimally, because China doesn't depend as much on this oil from the Middle East.
Professor Haley, thank you very much for speaking to me this morning.
Thank you.
And Professor Haley is an international business expert from Wichita State University. Back home, the federal government is focused on shoring up relations with Southeast Asian nations that supply Australia with petrol, diesel and jet fuel. Madeleine King is the Federal Resources Minister. Madeleine King, thanks very much for speaking to AM this morning.
It's a delight to be here. Thanks, Mel.
We've seen overnight President Donald Trump say that the US will blockade the Strait of Hormuz. This development can't be helpful to getting fuel supply back to normal.
Yeah, well, Australia, as you can imagine, supports freedom of navigation. It's really very important for all of global trade. But as a nation that depends on trading maritime lanes, it's even more important. So on the negotiations themselves, we hope that the parties can resume talks. De-escalation is what we've consistently called for as a government. I think it's what the Australian people would like to see as well. As for the blockade, that poses a very difficult position for global trade. And having any suggestion there might be some kind of permanent tolling on an important trade route by a regime that's listed as a terrorist organisation is just not a sustainable position.
So will the government be pressing the US government to not blockade the strait? Will there be direct discussions with counterparts to try and dissuade the US from taking that course of action?
We always talk with all of our partners. It's really important to remember. Obviously, America's our most important strategic partner in global affairs. So we continue to maintain our position about de-escalation. What the United States chooses to do around the blockade that they've suggested is a matter for them, and we'll wait to see how that eventuates. Really, the best thing Australia can do is encourage that both parties go back to the negotiating table and, you know, respect the work that all negotiators are doing. In particular, Pakistan hosting these talks have been very important over the weekend. But having a blockaded, having a tolling system around the Strait of Hormuz would be very, very difficult position for not only Australia, but for other countries in the region.
When it comes to securing fuel supply for Australia, we've seen the Prime Minister visit Singapore. He's heading off to Brunei and Malaysia this week. Is this a goodwill tour with those nations, or are there concrete outcomes that are expected from these visits?
Well, we've got great relationships with these countries already. The Singaporean trip to Singapore, the Prime Minister has just come back from, was really important. And that's a depth of relationship with Singapore in this country.
But this is more about reinforcing that relationship rather than a new agreement?
That's right. The Foreign Minister is travelling as well, and I think it's really important that our Prime Minister and our Foreign Minister go there and be there and meet with their counterparts. So it sends a very strong signal about where Australia sits in the geostrategic positioning in the world, but also a will to engage with our partners. They rely on us for lots of energy as well as we rely on them. So we want to remind everyone of that. And it's not just energy, it's food security as well. I mean, Australia does export a great deal of protein into the region, and to get that protein, we need our agriculture industry to thrive, and that does rely on diesel. So it's a very important chain here.
As we get closer to the budget being announced, can you give us any clarity about what changes to taxation for gas exports? What's on the table? What's off the table? Because yeah. I'm not sure the message is clear from the government at this point.
Well, it's going to be a difficult budget. We all know that. The budget's constrained by the disruption to global trade. We can't avoid that disruption. We can just manage it as best we can as a country. And the Treasurer's already said we'll be working on this until the very last minute to try and get the best position that we can for the nation.
And when it comes to gas exports specifically?
Yeah, well, there's been a lot of talk about different taxes and different systems, including on gas. So the thing I think it's important to remember is PRRT, the Petroleum Resource Rent Tax, doesn't apply to all gas exports. So I think that's what generates some of this discussion. For mine, I think it's worth people remembering that to have created this gas industry, which provides most of the domestic gas in this country, those companies had to invest tens of billions of dollars. If I think of Chevron as an $80 billion project, INPEX as another $80 billion project, and that's before we even talk about the Queensland project. So
you wouldn't want to see a change there? You think
it's a matter for the Treasurer and the whole Cabinet to decide. I'm not going to preempt any decision ahead of the budget. I just think it's worth thinking about what goes into these projects. They're not something that anyone can switch on and off. They're multi-decadal investment projects in a country where, the government doesn't own doesn't own the infrastructure. You know, this is something we depend on private capital to build out these industries, yep, which is different to what other countries are referred to in this debate sometimes.
Madeleine King, thanks very much for speaking to AM this morning.
Thanks so much, Mel.
And Madeleine King is the Federal Resources Minister. One of Donald Trump's biggest supporters in Europe has conceded defeat in the Hungarian election. Right-wing populist Viktor Orban has suffered a massive electoral loss, with Hungary's opposition set to record a landslide victory. Europe correspondent Elias Kluwer is in Budapest. He joined me a short time ago. Elias, it seems like it's a crushing defeat for Viktor Orban.
Absolutely, Mel. So most polls had Viktor Orban losing by up to 10, 15 percentage points. And the early results are indicating that Viktor Orban will likely lose by that amount. His challenger, Peter Magyar, is looking like he'll finish on about 55% of the vote. And I've been speaking to political insiders that say this is really a catastrophe, a political catastrophe for Viktor Orban in terms of just how much support he has lost. And the fact he has been gerrymandering constituencies, engineering the electoral system to make it almost impossible for anyone to defeat him. This really is such a momentous victory for Peter Magyar, who has led a very slick, flawless grassroots campaign here in Hungary.
So tell me a bit more about Peter Magyar. He used to be an ally of Viktor Orban, but he's become quite the critic, and he's promising to bring Hungary back closer to Europe. So how much do we know about how he will act as Prime Minister?
Well, we know that, as you say, he was a former Orban ally, but he claims that he left because he became disillusioned with how Fidesz was running the country. He's 45 years old, a former lawyer. He has grown in popularity and, as I say, really run a slick campaign here. But he is treated with some suspicion. People were just desperate for change, which is a big part of why he has been elected. But people are also concerned that perhaps Peter Magyar might be just more of the same. We'll wait and see. As you said, he's promising to bring Hungary back into the European fold, which would prevent or allow the EU to put more money into Hungarian coffers. It's been withheld due to the way in which Orban's been running the country. So that's what he's promising more support for Ukraine as well. But in terms of some of the other things that Viktor Orban has introduced in terms of restricting the judiciary, restricting LGBTQ rights, muzzling the free press, well, he hasn't really been that open about how he'll change or wind back some of the very draconian laws that Viktor Orban has introduced over his 16 years in power.
Elias Kluwer in Budapest there. Australia's democracy, like many around the world, is under sustained pressure. Citizens report increasing disillusionment with the major political parties, according to a new national report. Catherine Gregory has the details.
Father and son, Jared and Rob Zammit, are fairly confident Australia's political system and its institutions work.
I think our system serves us well with preferential voting and compulsory voting.
I think the AEC does a good job of remaining independent compared to a lot of other democracies. I think globally we're doing all right, but I think there's democracy fraying at the edges in some cases.
They're not so certain everyone shares their faith.
You know, the system's not working as well as it should for a lot of Australians, and I think there's frustration in that.
We're seeing an increase in the rise of popularity of minor parties, particularly One Nation. Do you think that's a reflection on that sort of disillusionment that we've been talking about?
Yeah, I'd agree with that disillusionment is pushing support for those minor parties. And I think it probably goes back to people perhaps frustrated with the status quo and there not being really a lot of alternatives.
These views on the fragile state of Australia's democracy are encapsulated in a Grattan Institute report. It found democracy around the world is in decline, and while Australia is still upholding some democratic values and some belief in our government's public service, education and legal systems, and even the media, there's a significant risk it may not last.
We see growing economic pessimism, worry about the prospects for future generations, concerns about unfairness, and a declining sense of belonging.
Kate Griffiths is the Deputy Director of the Grattan Institute's Democracy Program.
So satisfaction with democracy is typically lower among groups who are less well served by the status quo.
The report suggests building better community, protecting sources of information such as the media, ensuring governments are well prepared to withstand global shocks like the current fuel crisis, and building stronger policy-making processes.
So in terms of Parliament, what we see is an opportunity for an independent review. And the review could look at quite a few questions. The size of Parliament has been a question out there at the moment.
Ian McAllister is a professor of politics at ANU. He says the report confirms what recent elections have shown, that people are moving away from the major political parties.
What drives the vote is generation, education and gender. And that's a really fundamental change in terms of how people vote. The two major political parties have not really come to terms with this change. And that's one of the things that's leading people to de-align from the two major political parties. So there's a whole variety of things which are used overseas. A lot of these things could be evaluated here in terms of trying to restore faith in democracy.
Professor Ian McAllister from ANU, ending that report by Catherine Gregory. And that's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Melissa Clark.
Hi, I'm Sydney Peed from the ABC News Daily podcast. The ABC's Alan Kohler thinks the Treasurer should nationalise the childcare system, as concerns remain about the quality, safety and affordability of some centres. Is now the time for a radical shake-up? Today, Alan on if his idea could work, and a childcare policy expert on the case for change. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on ABC Listen.